recollection. I just need to be able to read my notes, and I think I'll be okay. You know, Sunday when Jack was here, he said one interesting thing in the class. He said he'd never taught a class like that on Sunday morning, where he had 45 minutes or so to go through one entire chapter. And after he said that, I thought, you know, Jack, I'm going to be in the same situation Wednesday night. I've never really done that too. In my teaching, I haven't done a whole lot of lecturing, which basically is what this is, but rather sat in classes where people had questions and we kind of talked among ourselves. It's interesting, as I look at those in the audience, this is about double the midweek size at NAMPA. We used to have five or six people for our midweek class in NAMPA, so I don't know what necessarily to do with such a large population. But it's good to have you all here. I will tell you up front that if you didn't bring a Bible, then you need to find one. I know they're underneath the seats because I have no overheads. I wasn't directed to make overheads. I do have the ability to do that. Just because I'm an old man doesn't mean that I can't work with PowerPoint. But anyway, I'm really not going to look at that in that sense. So we're going to, in just a few minutes, we're going to look at Genesis, the first chapter. But before I do that, I have three points that I really kind of want to make as an intro, kind of to introduce myself and introduce the methodology that I use to study. And point one is emphasized in John, the 16th chapter, and verse 13. Jesus is speaking to his apostles, and he says, "But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. For he will not speak on his own initiative, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will disclose to you what is to come." In a similar situation, but a different occasion, Jesus spoke to his apostles again, and it's recorded by Matthew and by Mark and by Luke, all three of those gospel writers. But specifically in Matthew, the 10th chapter, verses 18 through 20, Jesus says, "And you will even be brought before governors and kings for my sake as testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they hand you over, do not worry about how or what you are to say, for it will be given you in that hour what you are to say, for it is not you who speak, but it is the Spirit of your Father who speaks to you." And this deals directly with Jack's lesson on the sovereignty of God. And I asked Oliver Sunday morning, I said, did you set Jack up to do this because you knew I was going to teach on Wednesday night and it would be a perfect intro? And he said, no, it just kind of worked out that way. And the reason I bring this up is because this whole sovereignty of God and the free will of man impacts how we study the Bible. And one of the things that I believe personally is in verbal inspiration. And if you believe in verbal inspiration, that means you believe that God selected the words that the apostles taught verbally. He selected the words that they wrote later. And the reason that's important is because I think, even though this is Jesus speaking to his apostles, I think that's God's approach to his word even back in the Old Testament. So as we study the book of Genesis, keep this in mind that Moses didn't get to pick whatever words he wanted to express God's will. God controlled what Moses said. God picked the words out for him, I believe. And that's what verbal inspiration is all about. Now, some of you, hopefully most of you, are sitting out there saying, well, of course, that's the way God did it. Well, one of the reasons you have to be careful when you study commentaries is because most commentators don't believe in verbal inspiration. If you read their commentaries close, you'll see that their thought is that whoever the writer was, the writer got some kind of what today we might even think of as a broadcast from God, okay? And they got to pick how they wrote that information out. for a study a different time, at a different time, that would be a great topic to talk about verbal inspiration. But for right now, I want you to know as we talk tonight, because we're gonna look at some specific words, some Hebrew words. And that's where I'm coming from. I believe those words were selected by God for the writer to put down on the page. And in this case, when we're looking at Genesis, we're looking at Moses. Okay, Moses was the one that was directed by God to write in the fashion and use the words that he did. Now, I don't make a claim to be a scholar of Hebrew or any of the biblical languages or really much of anything. I spent most of my life flipping hamburgers. But the bottom line is I have a lot of good electronic aids that help me to better understand what God wants me to do. And that's why I focus in on words. I think that God has chosen that means to communicate with us. And if we pay attention to it, we can better understand how God wants us to live our lives. We know in 2 Peter, the first chapter and verse 3, the writer there said that God has given us everything that pertains unto life and godliness. That's all we need. All we need is God's word. And we'll have a good life, and we'll have a life in the hereafter too. The second point that I wanted to make is that sometimes, often we make the mistake when we're studying God's word, his revelation, that we equate the words author and the English words author and writer as meaning the same thing. And nothing could be further from the truth. God's the only writer, the author of the Bible. God is the only author of the Bible. And from Moses to John, every one of the writers that he picked were just the tools that he used to convey his message, his revelation. The third thing I think it's important that we keep in mind as we look at Genesis, when we study the Old Testament, you always need to keep in mind that the perspective of the writer, not the author, the perspective of the writer is typically historical. He's writing about events that are in the past, time-wise, even to him. So obviously, when Moses writes about the creation, he wasn't there at creation. In fact, we'll look at that in just a few minutes as to who was there. So if you look at Genesis, the first chapter, and verse 1, the subject of the revelation, that is the subject of the entire first chapter, is broadly revealed in verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that is what chapter 1 is all about. And then verses 2 through 31 reveal the details of that revelation. This is a pattern of revelation that God uses time and time again. If we study the Old Testament, we'll see it many times. We'll again see it in Genesis. This week, we'll look at chapter 1 in day 6. Who gets created in day 6? Anybody tell me? Man does, okay? But he doesn't give us a whole lot of details, does he? He talks about, let's create man in our image, and male and female created he them. And if you stop studying creation at that particular point, you won't have a whole lot of details. But if you go into chapter 2, you see this pattern again. There's a lot of information about how God created man and woman. And so that's something to keep in mind as you study Genesis. Okay, let's look at Genesis chapter 1 on a day-to-day basis. Day 1. Day 1 is the first 5 verses of the book. And I want to look at some of the words in verse 1. As I mentioned to Oliver the other day, I said, I'm not sure how far I'm going to get in chapter 1, but I'm pretty sure that I'll get through the first 5 verses. I may not get any further than that, but I'm gonna really try to get that far. In verse 1, In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. What are the two most important words there? God and created, okay? The subject of the sentence and the verb of action. And those are the two words that we want to talk about. I thought for a moment maybe talking about grammar, but most of us in here are old enough to actually have had some grammar lessons when we were in school. If you haven't, come see me after class sometime and we'll talk about grammar. But the bottom line is the subject of the sentence is God. He is the one that is going to do the creating. God is identified as the source of the creation. An interesting word is used here for God. Okay, it's Elohim. And Elohim is a plural noun. Strong's Greek-Hebrew definitions defines the word as gods in the ordinary sense. Now, exactly what that an ordinary sense for God means, I honestly don't know. But apparently, Strong's expects us to understand that. So gods in the ordinary sense, but specifically used of the supreme being. The question that immediately comes to my mind, and probably to yours too, although you probably know the answer, to whom does Elohim, a plural noun, refer? Well, one part of that question is answered for us in Paul's letter to the Colossians. Interesting that we'd have to wait until the Colossian letter written by Paul to get an actual answer from God about who he was talking about. In Colossians, the first chapter, starting in verse 13, "For he rescued us from the domain of darkness, and he transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation." Verse 13 through 15 is obviously talking about two beings. One of those being Jehovah, and the other one being Jesus Christ. And as we study Colossians, we all understand that. But when we get to verse 16, he specifically answers our questions about the who. "For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him." Clearly, both Jehovah and Jesus were at the creation. The only other being present at creation of the physical universe, which is what we're talking about, the physical universe, is mentioned in verse 2 of Genesis 1. "And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters." Now, we could probably spend a long time discussing, hopefully not arguing, but discussing how did the Spirit of God move over the waters? And to be perfectly candid with you, the only revelation that I have on that happens to be in Genesis, the first chapter, verse 2. And you can read it as well as I can. And I have no idea how the Spirit of God moved over the waters. Had he taken on some kind of physical form? Kind of seems that way to me. But I'm not going to argue either way. Moses, by inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says that he was there. So we know who did it and what did he do. And this is one of the reasons that it's important to sometimes look at the meaning of words. The Hebrew verb that is used here identifies what God did. What did God do? He created. Okay, he created. Now, Vine's Expository Dictionary, and if you don't happen to have a Vine's, I was going to say spend $14 and get one, except it's probably $114 now. That tells you how long ago I bought my original Vine's. Because that's pretty much what I paid for. It was $14, $15. Vine says created, and this is a quote, means create or make. He goes on to say this verb is of profound theological significance since it has only God as its subject. keep that in mind. This word bara is only used in reference to God. Only God can create in the sense implied by bara. The verb expresses creation out of nothing. Let me repeat that. The verb expresses creation out of nothing. An idea, as Vines goes on to say, an idea seen clearly in passages having to do with creation on a cosmic scale. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. Compare that with Genesis 2:3, where bara is used. Isaiah 40, verse 26, and Isaiah 42, verse 5. All other verbs for creating, and there are three of them in Hebrew, allow a much broader range of meaning. They have both divine and human subjects and are used in contexts where bringing something or someone into existence is not the issue. Bara is frequently found in parallel with these Hebrew words. And the three that you see most often are Asa, Yatzar, and Kun. And that's my pronunciation. They may be pronounced some other way if you are Hebrew. Vine's dictionary also makes note that of the fact that a verse that illustrates all of these words together is Isaiah 45, verse 18. And if you happen to have a Bible there, I would recommend that you look up Isaiah 45, 18, because I'm going to read it twice. Once I'm going to read it as it reads in the American Standard Version, and then I will read it substituting the verbs for the Hebrew. For thus says the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it and he created it, not in vain, he formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Now, if we substitute the four Hebrew words that are used frequently for this concept of creation, okay, Isaiah 45, 18 reads this way, for thus saith the Lord that borrowed, and making it past tense is kind of makes the word sound a little crazy, but that's what it would say. Thus saith the Lord that borrowed the heavens, God himself that yatzard the earth, and Asa it, he borrowed it, not in vain, he yatzard it to be inhabited, I am the Lord, and there is none else. And the only reason I bring this up is that these are all words that people, our religious friends, argue about. And you can spend hours and days arguing about words. Paul warned Timothy about that. You know, be careful, don't get into discussions, you know, about words, because they can create problems for you. Now, I fully understand that there is not one word in the Bible that was written in English. Okay, it was written in Hebrew, and it was written in Aramaic, and it was written in Syriac, and it was written in Koine Greek. But I believe in a God also that has the power to control how people translate language. And I feel very confident that the dictionaries that I use, particularly Vines and Strong's, which are considered authorities by virtually everybody in the religious world, or in the Christian religious world. Some religious worlds could care less about Vines and Strong's. But anyway, what's important here is that they agree that these are the words. And the one that's particularly important to remember is bara, B-A-R-A. Because of the concept, as you study it, it clearly indicates the creation of something from nothing. And that's what we've claimed all along. In fact, that's one of the arguments that we make with our scientific friends sometimes. You know, there was a Big Bang. Well, where did all the elements that came together and caused this Big Bang come from? I don't know. Ask Joe. He can probably tell you better about that than I can. But the bottom line is, when God gave his revelation to Moses, that's the word he told him to use. And that's what it's talking about. In verse 2, we find the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the water. There's a couple words here I want to talk about. Earth first. Now, obviously, I think we all recognize the fact that they're not talking about the dirt and the rocks that compose the earth. They're talking about the planetary body. And what he says about that planetary body is it was formless. It was the Hebrew word used here means desolate. Okay, there wasn't a specific makeup. It was it's hard for us to talk about or think about something like this because we've never experienced it. And God created us a being that deals with experience, our senses, feel, touch, smell, taste. But what we're talking about here is this, for want of a better term, this glob of matter that was out there that God had not yet turned into a specific form. He's going to do that in another day or two. And then the second one was void. And this, the idea in Hebrew of this term void is it had no life on it. There was, not only was it without any specific form, but it had no life. Either plant life or animal life did not exist on it. And it was in darkness, which I find fundamentally difficult to understand. I have never been without life or without light in my entire existence. People tell me that if you go down into Carlsbad Caverns, anybody here ever been to Carlsbad Caverns? If you go down to Carlsbad Caverns, part of the tour is they take you down, okay, and you go down with lots of light so you can see where you're going so you don't trip and embarrass yourself. But then once they get you to one of the places in the tour, they turn the lights out. And you literally cannot see your hand in front of your face. That's darkness. And that's all that existed before God, as we'll see in just a moment, spoke light into existence. How did he do that? I have no idea. He spoke it into existence. It had never existed before. In verse 3, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. It just blows my mind. God said, let there be light, and light was. You know, think about it. Unless you're blind or losing your eyesight, I guess I can talk to my wife about that, but you know, we've never been there. There's always been light. Maybe it wasn't doing exactly what we wanted it to do, but it's a fact of life. That's what's supposed to be. Well, prior to God speaking it into an existence, it did not exist. Verse 4, God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God identifies the light as good. Okay. It seems to me this is a comparison with darkness. He's preferring light to darkness. Why? Doesn't explain it here. Perhaps it has to do with the power of light to illuminate. That seems a logical conclusion to me. But God's a spiritual being. He doesn't need light to see. So the only reason that God made light was for us. Because we need light. At some point in time, I say some point in time, but actually time won't exist. At some point in eternity, we won't need light anymore, apparently. We'll be in a spiritual body. Exactly what that's going to be, God hasn't revealed to us. But we're going to be there. God's already got it prepared for us, according to the Corinthian letter. So that was, God called the light day, verse 5, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening and there was morning, one day. God didn't label a whole lot of things in creation. He labeled lightness and dark. He labeled day and he labeled night. And most of the other things that were created were named by who? By Adam. By Adam. Yes, that's true. Yes. And earth is used in two different ways, and we'll talk about that in just a second. Okay, thank you. So day one ends. Day one's gone. God has created the heavens, he's created the earth, and he's created light. Darkness already existed, apparently. Day two, God separates the waters of the earth with the expanse. This expanse is what we today call atmosphere. It's called the heavens. It's the arc of the sky that is between the earth and outer space. I guess we would talk about it today. How many layers there are? Scientists can tell you all about that. I honestly don't know, but that's what he's talking about here. There's an area above the earth that has moisture in it. God here calls it the waters above the earth. And let there be an expanse, verses 6 through 8. Then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. When I was younger, that always threw me. I didn't understand what he was talking about. But he's talking about that space that exists between the heavenly waters, that is, only thing I can think of, the moisture, the accumulation of moisture that today we look at it, it comes down out of the clouds, okay? It exists there. Separate the waters from the waters. God made this expanse and separate the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning, a second day. Day three, God separates the waters of the earth, and that creates dry land. On the dry land, he creates vegetation, plants and trees. In verses 9 and 10, we find this. Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. Now, this is a natural consequence, if you think about it. God gathers the waters together, and where there is no water, what do you have? You have dry land. That's the only alternative. You have this formless void, okay? This glob of matter that's out there that's made up of earth and water. And apparently water predominated for at least the first 2 days. And then God separated the waters. He separated the waters above the earth, and then he brought the waters here in day three that are on the earth together, and the dry land was a natural consequence of him doing that. It came into being. It was exposed, whatever term you want to use. We can do the same thing today, or maybe we did, some of us anyway, the guys, when we were out playing in the mud when we were much younger, or down at the beach and you were building sandcastles and you needed some water in order to mix the mud properly. And so you see, we had somewhat a similar experience, okay? Except God did it from nothing. In verse 10, God called the dry land earth. Okay, this is the same word, the same Hebrew word that's used in verse 2 that refers to this. For all I can think of is a globe, but it may not have been a globe. It may have been a cube. I don't know what it was at that particular point in time, because God said it was what? Formless. Okay, it's formless and it's void. It's void because it has no life on it. It's formless because God had not put it in the shape he wanted it finally to be in. This is what my scientific writer friends would call planetary modification. If you're a science fiction fan, and I am, I underline the word fiction, okay? I enjoy most science fiction. But, you know, that's what God modified the planet to the form that it is today. Or that it was. No, I'm not going to say that, because we'll get into a discussion about all these millions of years that our scientific friends claim existed. But he labels the dry land as earth. Again, it's same Hebrew word. And the waters as seas. Then in verses 11 through 12, we find this. Then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees on the earth bearing fruit after their kind, with seed in them, and it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. God commands the earth, this mass of soil and dirt and water, okay? Understand that. He's not talking to man, who later will plant seeds, okay? But he's talking to this matter itself, okay? And he commands it to bring forth vegetation, plants and trees with seeds, each after their own kind. You don't, even today, you don't plant a eucalyptus tree and expect to get a palm. You expect to get a eucalyptus, because they are two different kinds, two different species of tree. And so God commands the land to bring forth this vegetation. Now, how did that happen? It's kind of like the light, you know? God spoke it, and it happened. God commanded the earth to produce vegetation. And being obedient to God, isn't that an interesting concept? The physical earth being obedient to God, it produced vegetation, each after its own kind. Not all conglomerated together, each after his own kind. And in verses 12, and or ending 12 and 13, and God saw that it was good. That's going to be a popular theme throughout the rest of the chapter. God saw that it was good. There was evening and there was morning, a third day. So we're 24, 48, 72 hours into creation. We now have formation of the planet. We have earth, physical earth, dirt, rocks, whatever you want to think of, soil. We have seas, water, and we have plants on the soil. Now, were there also plants in the seas? I don't know, God, it's not mentioned. Isn't that interesting? Again, subject for another study at some point in time. Day 4, God creates celestial bodies. Okay, so when God spoke and said, let there be light, what did the light not come from?
Yeah, it didn't come from the sun or the moon or any other celestial body. Why? God hadn't created them yet. They're not created until the fourth day. And that's what we find in the fourth day. The question that often raises in human minds, in fact, one of the questions we always ask, besides who, is what? W-H-Y. Why? Why did God do this? Well, frequently, I don't mean to sound facetious when I say this, but I can see God thinking, man doesn't really need to know the whys of all of these things. But in this case, God gives us the whys. In verses 14 through 19, then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens. Number one, to separate the day from the night. Okay. Number two, let them be for signs, for seasons, and for days and years. Today we would call that our calendar. That was God's purpose. He wants us to be able to calculate what? Time. And so he gives us the sun and the moon and the other celestial bodies to be used in that manner. Number three, then let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on earth, and it was so. Why do we need the lights? Anybody ever try and stumble around at night without a flashlight? Been there, done that. God didn't need the illumination. We need it. We're the weak ones. And then in verse 16 through 19, he goes on and gives some more details. God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, that is the sun, and the lesser light to govern the night, the moon, and he made stars also. And God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, and to govern the day and the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and morning, a fourth day. So now we have 96 hours gone. We get to day five. God creates birds and sea life. And I can't read it signed back there, but if I can look at it, it looks like the clock says I have 4 minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. God creates birds and sea life. In verse 21, God creates birds and sea life. And it's pretty well self-explanatory. And then God said, let the waters teem. And this idea of teeming means bring forth abundantly. That's what the Hebrew word means. With swarms of living creatures. And let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. And God created, bara, the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind, and God saw that it was good. Interesting, in verses 22 and 23, what does God do? God blesses the birds and the sea creatures. God blessed them. Only thing that could be them was what he had just created that could refer to. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas and let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. Day six, God creates all the land animals and man. In verses 24 through 25, God creates all the creatures that live on the earth, that is on dry land. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind. Where are the living creatures coming from? Coming from the earth. How? I don't know. And neither do you. We can make all kinds of guesses and we can make all kinds of speculations, but all we have is let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind. Cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Verse 26 and 27. God creates man in his image and gives man rule over every other creature on earth. This idea of image, I was going to talk a little bit about, but it's like so many words, as you look at the dictionary definition, there are different options that you can look at. It means a phantom. It means illusion. It means resemblance. It means a representative figure, okay? That's what Strong says. And then God said, let's make man in our image, according to our likeness. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Throughout verse 27, the word created that is used there is always bara. In verse 26, where it says, let us make man, that's asa, not bara that's used. And then the concept of rule, basically, God gave us the rule over every other creature on the face of this planet. Verse 26, and so let them, that is man, rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle, over all the earth, over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And again, this is all bara, where the word created is used. In verse 28, God gives his first recorded blessing and commands to man. God blessed them, that is man, and said to them, be fruitful and multiply. He had already told the animals that, so he can't be talking about the animals. Fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Now, our friends can argue as much as they want that puppy dogs and little cats and all of those things are important. And there's a sense in which they are. But the bottom line is, we're in charge of the earth. Why are we in charge of it? Because God gave us that responsibility. Now, you know as well as I do, if you abuse a responsibility that God's given you, that is, in a sense I'm talking about here, if you're abusing the other creatures that God's created, God's not going to be happy with you, because that's not what God intended us to do. But God did intend us to use them to our advantage. No question in my mind about that. Verse 29, God gives food to man. Then God said, behold, I have given every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth, and every tree which is a fruit yielding seed. It is food for you. After meat was not given to man until chapter 9 of Genesis, verses 1 through 4. So we all started out, our predecessors all started out as vegetarians. But in chapter 9, right after what event? The flood. Right after the flood, we were given meat. One of the reasons probably being is it's really hard to plant plants in muddy terrain and expect them to grow. Being somewhat of a gardener, let me assure you, I know what I'm talking about a little bit. Verse 30, God blesses the birds and all the land animals. And to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the sky, and he's talking about the plants, and to everything that moves on the earth, which has life, I have given every green plant for food, and it was so. And then the final verse, God appraises his work of creation. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning,
the sixth day. I can't read the clock, but I know I'm over. So I will stop. Thank you all for your kind attention.